I want to apologize to everyone for being late. I'm very glad that none of my students are here because I always harangue them about the when they walk in a few minutes late. I also want to welcome our new commissioner, Commissioner Ordon, for joining us. We're so pleased to have you, and I think it's going to be a wonderful contribution. And we really, I know I speak for the staff and my fellow commissioners when I say we really look forward to working with you.
Well, I certainly share the anticipation, and I'm so pleased to be here.
So without further ado, we will, item number one, call the meeting to order. And item number two is our draft minutes. And I've reviewed the draft minutes. I would move to approve the draft minutes.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
The draft minutes are approved. All right.
Sorry, I have a clarifying question. When we voted to approve the recommendations, but now we're talking about them again, that means we can still change them, right? Okay, that's all. Thanks.
We are having an ideological discussion about conceptually approving a potential idea. do we have a possible neighborhood council discussion? No. Okay. Item number four is the recusal review of Ms. Martinez, which we've been here. Oh, Mr. Hardy, I'm sorry. Come up. How are the elevators treating you?
Very well.
Thank you. I think this, we've seen Ms. Martinez before. I have reviewed the recommendations. It does seem to be continuing because I know that her Berkshire Hathaway retirement funds she will continue to own is seems to be very financially reasonable, but it seems to be not significant because I believe it was less than 5 or 6% of her job she had to recuse herself from, and then a certain percentage of that was actually for informational items.
That's correct.
So if my fellow commissioners have any question on this issue. Yes.
I don't have any question. I just want to say for the record that Vilma Martinez has been a friend for 30, 40 years, but I certainly share the way you are reading the matter, and I don't think there's any reason to recuse myself from it.
Good. I don't think so either. Any other questions? I know this is kind of a standard for us to look at the significant and continuing.
I'll move to approve the recommendation.
All right, I would move to second the recommendation to adopt the resolution in attachment F to find President Martinez does not have a significant and continuing conflict of interest at this time. All those in favor?
Aye.
Item number five, we have some public comment. This is our conceptual idea about possibly talking about a further discussion of lobbying. And we have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 public comments on this item. So let's start the clock. Mr. Sutton? Welcome. And we have a letter from you as well.
Yes. Yes, from our firm works with the LA Lobbyist Association, which is kind of an informal trade association of lobbying firms and lobbying entities, and we worked with the commission and staff in the past on changes, and we're looking forward to doing the same this time. And just definitely want to start by saying certainly our clients' goals are really the same, I think, as yours, meaning transparency, full disclosure, but also ease of compliance, and then it would be ease of enforcement for you. So saying that, the new definitions that are proposed, we're generally in agreement. We think that staff has done a great job changing some of the definitions, changing some of the terms, with a few minor comments outlined in our letter. But we do have three issues we'd like to talk about today. The first is the definition or the registration threshold for lobbying firms. And what staff had kind of concluded, and we agree with, is the old registration threshold, which is, does an employee of the firm spend 30 or more hours in a three-month period lobbying, that's kind of unworkable and that's undifficult, and both from an enforcement perspective but also a compliance perspective. But what they propose, which is changing from 30 hours to earning $2,000 in a year, that's really no different. And when you're an employee of a firm and you're trying to figure out, did I earn $2,000 for lobbying? Well, how do you do that? You have to estimate how many hours you spent on that. You multiply it by your salary. So it's the exact same thing. It even makes it more difficult because now it's not just hours. It's also hours plus money. What we really suggest the commission look at is San Francisco and San Diego both did a full comprehensive review of their lobbying ordinances about 5 years ago. And I really encourage staff to talk to, and I'd be more than happy to put them in touch with the staffs in San Francisco and San Diego, because those, I think, did a very comprehensive job. Both of those agencies concluded that for lobbying firms, which are consulting firms, law firms, PR firms, it's not about hours. It's not about how much money the employees earn. It's about what the clients pay in fees. So both of those agencies moved to a threshold based on what the clients pay. And frankly, they took the threshold down to $1, right? Do you mind if I continue? And that's the state law has the exact same rule. They look at fees paid to firms. The federal lobbying law has the exact same rule. So we encourage the commission to not really just stick with hours and salary, but go to fees. Our second.
Can I move to that? I just have a clarifying question.
Please.
You said that the current 30 hours doesn't work because you didn't say the because.
Well, okay. It is difficult. So if you're an employee of a firm, and the question is how many hours did you work? Now, if you're a lawyer, you're keeping track of your time in 6-minute increments, and it's easy to figure out what you've done. But if you're not, by definition, it's always going to be an estimate. It's always going to be inaccurate. Now, certainly our clients, most of whom are going to register anyway, right? They're going to estimate high. What the staff has determined in enforcement matters is how do you prove whether someone worked 30 hours or 40 hours? It's all just based on guesses, right? Because there's no requirement that they keep their time in 6-minute increments, and as a lawyer, I wouldn't want anyone else to have to do that. So that's why it's been what staff has certainly said, and we don't disagree with, is that when it comes to trying to prove or disprove that someone's crossed that threshold, it's very it certainly more work than it needs to be. Where if it's based on fees, there's an invoice, and they send it to the client, and the client would bill that much, and
so
it's much clearer.
How would that work then for in-house?
And that's great. And that's our next comment. So what San Francisco and San Diego also did is they kind of concluded, and just to go back a step, lobbying, unlike campaigning, lobbying compliance and lobbying reporting is an art, not a science, because it's not about kind of dollars in and dollars out of a bank account. So any system you have for determining who qualifies is going to be a qualitative question, and it's not going to be a perfect system. So what San Francisco and San Diego did is said, you know what? Having employees estimate their time, it's just too difficult. And what is a better, not necessarily perfect, but what's a better way to look at whether an organization, whether it's a nonprofit, a business, or a labor union, whether that organization should be reporting its lobbying activity? Let's look at how many times all of their employees, not just one by one, but in total, how many times their employees are interacting with city officials. So both San Francisco and San Diego moved to a contacts test. Don't quote me on this. I think it's in our letter. I think San Diego is, do all employees of the organization have 10 contacts with city officials in a 2-month period? I think San Francisco is 5 contacts in a 3-month, again.
It's yeah. 5 in a 2-month.
Thank you.
So under that system, then, it would be the company that not the person.
Exactly. And both, again, I don't want to put everything on San Francisco and San Diego, but what they said is what does the public want to know? The public wants to know whether Times Warner is lobbying City Hall matters, whether SEIU is lobbying, and then what they require is on their quarterly report, it's which one of your employees contacted city officials during the quarter. So the public also knows who are the people at the organizations, but they kind of determined, basing the registration on individuals qualifying as a lobbyist, and from a compliance perspective, very difficult. What the way the other jurisdictions now do enforcement, and I guess I don't want to turn in my clients, right? But it's all emails now. So an email, just the bottom line, it's easier to track. So you do a public records act request for all emails between this organization and the council offices. Now they come out. You go through the emails and say, well, this one doesn't count as a contact because they're just asking for a document. This one is just a repeat of the other one. But it's much easier to determine whether they've reached 10 contacts or 5 contacts or whatever it is.
Sorry, and then my last follow-up to that would be then, so then how does if you disclose the company and you might identify the people,
right?
How do you then, you know, we have another set of laws that restrict what lobbyists can do, so then who do we apply that to?
Right.
The entire company?
And I think the staff's struggling with that too. They got rid of that whole model. And they don't, the restrictions, frankly, I think are a little stricter in San Diego, but they don't apply necessarily to that person. Right, and so that is the trade-off, right? That then, for instance, the prohibition on contributions from lobbyyists, well, that wouldn't apply, right?
For in-house,
exactly. And I think again, there's trade-offs, but I don't think these other jurisdictions feel like they've lost anything in terms of compliance.
So just to clarify, you're saying that the prohibitions or the restrictions only apply to the people who are in direct contact with the elected officials?
Right now in the city, they only apply if you qualify as a lobbyist.
Uh-huh.
In San Diego, they don't have lobbyists,
okay.
So you'd have to determine which prohibitions should apply because...
For in-house, to clarify, it's in-house. So
for
if you work
right.
for SEIU, everybody... So potentially we have two scenarios. Everybody in SEIU now would not be able to give, for example, because
right.
they would
right.
all be under that.
They would be a lobbying.
Or the flip side would be everybody at SEIU could give now.
Okay.
Right, but the organization couldn't.
Or
right.
we come up with some other.
Right. In my mind, I was thinking of more of like a Berghoff and Associates.
And that's a whole different ball of wax.
Right.
And I think the questions raise another important point that with in-house organizations, the concern that the lobby association has is obviously everyone should register if they need to. It's CEOs of companies and executive directors of nonprofits who are highly compensated. Right, or more highly compensated. So very often, as you guys know, a city council person is dealing with a government affairs person and finally gets to a point that says, I need to talk to the head honcho. So the head honcho might go in for 2, 3, 4, 5 council meetings, have prep time for that, and if you set the threshold at $2,000, that person's going to qualify based on 1 or 2 meetings. And what we would say is, that's not really what the lobbying law. They don't want the CEO to have to register just because they have this one meeting. The state, the way the state got around it, they adopted a rule that if your registered lobbyist coordinates the meeting, the CEO doesn't have to register. My recollection, and this is kind of, and maybe Heather might remember this, when LA moved to 30 hours, which was at least 10 years ago, that was because of the CEO issue. That when it was based on compensation, then whether you qualified as a lobbyist, what could happen was the CEO or the executive director of the nonprofit had to register, but the government affairs person didn't because they weren't making as much, so it was harder to reach $2,000. So that is another kind of important point with in-house lobbyists.
And then so, the third. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, and I thank you for the extra time. The last point is about the exception for 501c3 nonprofits. Our recollection, again, it's buried deep in the bowels of the legislative history, is that was meant to be a very narrow exception. And we know that several nonprofits have come up and talked about the burden that lobbying reporting puts on them. But what hasn't really been discussed, we believe, is the important role, the huge role, and the impact that nonprofits can have on policy in City Hall. And we really think there are constitutional concerns when you start effectively discriminating against a filer based on their mission. And certainly, at the very least, we think that it suggests a more thorough analysis from the city attorney's office, whether it's legal for a government to say, you nonprofit, you organization, because of your business structure, because of your mission, you don't have to file, but you over here, you do have to file. That I think that kind of raises constitutional concerns that should be addressed.
Though, of course, we treat nonprofits differently in a host of ways all the time. Was there more questions? Okay. I think, Mr. Hardy, we are going to have to ask you to come up after, but I know that Mr. Previn also has to
thank
go.
You.
So thank you, Mr. Sutton. And so let's have Mr. Previn, because I know he also has to go. And then, Mr. Hardy, I think maybe some clarification of exactly how this works before our discussion would be good as well. All right.
Thank you, Ethics Commission. It's Eric Previn from Studio City, and I appreciate your hearing me. I did not receive a hall pass from the County Board of Supervisors this morning, unfortunately, so I have to limit my comments and move quickly. I agree with the previous speaker that when we get into 501c3 exemption space, we run into some problems with different kinds of 501c3s. And in Mr. Hardy's excellent report, there was some review of how 501c3s have to disclose that they have been lobbying or whether or not they have been lobbying in their 990s, which, you know, as you know, in the past I've raised Harvard-Westlake did not check the box that they were lobbying for a number of years, and yet obviously we're lobbying to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I think that we have to ask ourselves, are we going to enforce this stuff across the board? Would be a good question for the new Commissioner Orton, who obviously is steeped in these matters. The other stuff that's in here, which is really interesting, has to do with the idea of just a slight language change under the prohibition section, where you're changing it from city official fraudulently deceiving or attempting to deceive a city official regarding a material fact is pertinent to pending or proposed municipal legislation. That's the current. And the new one, we're going to take out fraudulently and just put, you know, an effort to deceive or attempt to deceive a city employee regarding a material fact that is pertinent to a city matter. So it expands what that would cover, which is very interesting. Last week, if I'm not mistaken, at item 45, during one of the meetings, there was an AT&T event, which was an item in which they lobby through Englander, Knobby, and Allen. And they came before the council, and I'd gone to the committee because I was so exercised about it, because they felt that they had overpaid to the tune of $900,000. And they were bringing their claim for refund to the city hall. And they hired a lobbyist, obviously. They have a lobbyist. They pay this lobbyist a lot of money. And so the question became, what must the city council officials be feeling when they're being pressured to do this kind of a deal for these lobbyists? And they did a deal, in fact. And they, you know, the part that caught my attention was that among the other clients of Englander, Knobby, and Allen, they are the largest lobbyists, for those who don't know. They have a very lucrative arrangement. They also have a partnership with Arnie Berghoff, who is the second or the fourth or third or seventh. He always goes up and down, but he's also a big lobbyist. They share an office. But the concern that I have is that in addition to Englander, Knobby, and Allen representing AT&T, they also represent a group called the City Attorney of Los Angeles Association. Now, that got me a little concerned because I thought, well, wait a minute. Aren't they influencing the city attorneys to provide this refund? Even though, by the way, the item came before an administrative body, the AT&T refund, and then they lost. They came before an appellate administrative body. They lost. So now they bring it to the lobbyist. The lobbyist brings it to the city attorney and Krikorian and budget and finance. They all go closed session, and then they come to the meeting, and it's done. And I just feel very awkward that the city attorneys as a group are lobbying through the same group. I mean, do we not have any restrictions on those kinds of conflicting representations? I mean, that's something to really look closely at. Another example that I'll be very brief, but when we talk about hiring consultants who are acting under the agency, you know, in any capacity, we've made that language in the proposed, the recommended municipal lobbyist ordinance changes. I'm concerned that some of those, that's too broad in a strange way, because, you know, I saw something in City Hall that I don't know how this fits into it, but it was upsetting. There was obviously a lobbyist there, and he was coaching a speaker, and he was writing the guy's speech. And so obviously the kid, who was adorable, was not a lobbyist, but he was being kind of shoveled into the mix, probably for free or maybe for some, I don't know. I just feel that maybe lobbyists should be asked to wear body cameras or something, or maybe we can register them, because when we're in City Hall, you can see Arnie Berghoff if you know who he is, but you wouldn't know if you're an ordinary resident. And we want to know if someone's in the hall at $2,000 an hour working an agenda on whether they're a 501c3, I remember you cited Lane earlier, or not a corporation. I think we want to know who is influencing our government officials at all times. And so that's my comment on item number five. On item number 7, I'll just leave now. I'm just going to say one word because I know you have a lot of stuff going on. It's the election update. I wrote in the Daily News an article about the charter, and I'm concerned that Mike Fiore and Mayor Garcetti, who are raising a lot of money right now actively for the 2017, I don't blame them. They have a fight. I'm concerned that they're being taken away from their duties and that they need to look closely at the charter and the appointment issues that arose in CD7. That's the council district that was vacated by Mr. Felipe Fuentes, as you recall. And then we've had a small, not coup, but a taking over in some unspecified way that is not clear and not in the charter. So again, the new Commissioner Orton, who's very, very versed, will help. Hopefully we can get to some of the bottom of these things, and I appreciate your giving me the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Previn. If my fellow commissioners are okay with it, I think we should just finish the public comment before we have Mr. Hardy come back up. So we have a no-name from the Alliance for Justice and Ms. Randall from the Alliance for Justice. Are you keeping me on my toes?
Good morning. I'm Nona Randois, so I'm not the no-name.
Oh.
And you did a good job of pronouncing it. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
My French teachers are not rolling over in their graves right
no,
now.
No, not at all. We made up the last name, so it's your French teachers wouldn't really have any responsibility for that. So good morning. I'm Nona Randois. I'm the director of the Alliance for Justice's Los Angeles office. We provide legal support to nonprofits to help support their engagement in advocacy work. And we work with hundreds of nonprofits in Los Angeles. We provide training and support for nonprofit organizations. For example, we recently published a fact sheet on the Los Angeles Municipal Lobbying Ordinance to help nonprofits navigate their compliance responsibilities. So you can find that on our website. I wanted to start by thanking the staff for meeting with us. We weren't able to get a big or a representative group together on short notice, but we do appreciate you taking the time to hear us out and addressing a few of our concerns. And so for the commission, I wanted to share some of the concerns and proposals that we raised with the staff. 501c3 organizations are treated differently from other actors in the city in many respects. Based on federal law, they're in a different classification, and they don't fit the typical pattern of a lobbying scenario where individuals or businesses are acting in their own self-interest. Instead, they're advocating on behalf of disadvantaged people and communities. Oftentimes, C3s are providing support for homeless people, children in the foster care system, and others who are hard-pressed to participate in city decision-making processes, let alone hire a lobbyist. And oftentimes, nonprofits are helping these folks advocate on their own behalf. Unlike businesses, unions, and trade associations, which are organized around and have a fiduciary responsibility to the self-interest of members and shareholders, 501c3s, by federal law, are limited to certain kinds of missions. As part of that restriction, 501c3s cannot donate to, support, or oppose candidates for office, and so concerns about corruption are not the same as with groups who can. Another way in which 501c3s are different from other groups is that they are limited by federal law as to how much lobbying they can do at all. Generally, only an insubstantial amount is allowed. They have to track and report to the IRS all lobbying they do at all levels of government based on IRS definitions. Many are totally prohibited from legislative lobbying because either they're private foundations or because they receive restricted funding. Even though these prohibitions do not prohibit these organizations from participating in administrative or executive decisions of the city of Los Angeles, as opposed to legislative ones, all of those are caught up in the municipal lobbying ordinance, as you know. The different definitions create a burden, forcing organizations who are generally starved for resources to use two different tracking and reporting systems if they want to participate in local government. And in some cases, the differing definitions create an insurmountable perception problem that will keep people from participating in any city activity that, although permissible and even desirable for them to participate based on their unique expertise, requires them to register and report as lobbyists.
Sorry, just as a clarification, the two systems you're comparing are the IRS system mm-hmm. and then whatever would be passed at the local level?
Correct, or the existing local regime.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we believe the simplest, most most efficient and most legally defensible, easiest to administer response to these concerns would be a blanket 501c3 exemption. So staff mentioned in their report that San Jose and Long Beach have such exemptions, and I have a list of the other cities that also have that kind of rule, so I can share these with you all, and I have some extras for other members who are interested. There are at least 11 jurisdictions in California alone that have a blanket exemption from their local lobbying ordinances for 501c3s.
And how many do a modified regulation of 501c3s?
A lot more. I didn't count that number, but there are several that I can think of, San Francisco being lead among them.
And what checks or balances would be in place to prevent somebody from just forming a 501c3 to avoid, right? So let's say ABC Corporation then forms a 501c3, funds it. It's now exempt from the laws, but its issue aligns with what ABC Corporation may have mm-hmm. also lobbied the city for. What's in place to prevent that from happening?
Federal law under the tax exempt law, that organization would be a private foundation, which would be prohibited from doing any kind of legislative lobbying by federal law.
But in theory, they could, somebody could just start a 501c3 that's independent of that, and they could just be one of the major funders. I mean, they could also have other funding, but they could be one of their major funders.
So there's a very complex test that's based on the breadth of support of a 501c3 to see if they're a private foundation or not. Mm-hmm. And sure, people are free to violate federal law if they'd like to. That's definitely true. I can't argue with that. There's a series of formulas that essentially look at the breadth of support that a 501c3 receives, and if they have a limited number of sources of funds, like the example that you're raising, they would be a private foundation, which means they would be prohibited from doing legislative lobbying. If not, then they are required under federal law to track and report the lobbying that they do on their 990s. We'll talk about kind of the definitions and how having different definitions is a challenge. But it does mean that anyone who's reporting at the city level, who's a 501c3, because they have to also report under federal law, has to do two separate sets of tracking.
Sorry, I only ask. Yeah. On our other side on campaign finance, we see a mm-hmm. lot of manipulation of organizational structures to kind of funnel money into politics. And so I think that when we go down a path like this with the exemption, we just have to think through, because I mm-hmm. think when people thought of Citizens United, a lot of people might have foreseen, but a lot of people didn't think it would happen, and we've all seen what's happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why it's important to keep in mind that 501c3s are strictly prohibited, not only from contributing to candidates, but also from doing anything that's seen to any kind of activity that's seen to support or oppose a candidate for office. So it's a different set of considerations. We did raise with the staff some alternatives to the idea of a blanket exemption that we think, if for some reason that's not something that the commission is able to support at this time, that we think would better address the special nature and restrictions and challenges that are faced by 501c3. So our proposal starts with the existing staff recommendation for the exemption and adds an exemption for any 501c3 who engages disadvantaged and underrepresented people and communities in city decision making. So one of my colleagues will talk a little bit more about the necessity for that exemption. And it would also add an exemption for any 501c3 that has a certain level of gross receipts. So we looked at the federal definition, U.S. Small Business Administration, of a small civic or social organization. They say $7.5 million is a small civic or social organization. So those are our proposed additions to and the exemption proposed by the staff.
Can I ask you just to, mm-hmm. to give you an opportunity to respond to a question I'm going to have for staff later, but mm-hmm. I'd like to hear your expertise on it. Mm-hmm. What do you guys say to the concern that if we were to go down either a blanket exception or a more specific based on the type of organization, that that proposes a content-based, you know, we're now kind of regulating mm-hmm. who does and who doesn't get a chance to speak, if you will.
Right. Well, that's why we think blanket exemption is just simplest and easiest, because there's no question that there would be some kind of problem of making a distinction based on 501c3. It's a distinction under federal law, so there's not, I don't think there's any concern at all that really makes sense to say that the city can't make a distinction based on that. You know, perhaps within, if you're dealing within 501c3, a slightly more of a even colorable argument, but I still think that it's perfectly reasonable for the city to target the largest actors in the system. And I actually think that based on your mission of making city government fair, we all understand that people who have more money have more power and access in our system, and that's why we're here, right? So creating a system that you know, applies laws differently to allow people who have less money, less access, to participate on a more equal footing, seems to be very much in line with your mission, very reasonable.
But wouldn't there be a distinction then being made between profit and nonprofit, right? That's the distinction. Those entities that are for profit versus those that are nonprofit, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And aren't there nonprofits that have larger budgets than for-profit entities?
Yeah.
So,
but it's they're restricted in their mission of having some kind of charitable mission.
But there could be,
and there is already a distinction based on federal law. So, making that distinction is not going to be seen as a problematic.
Okay, I think maybe Renee will advise this maybe later, but my understanding is that there could be an issue on the so for example, on any given issue, I agree that most of the time you're going to have nonprofits coming to the city to advocate based on some issue that's for social good, because by nature that's what a 501c3 is. But I think there will be for-profits that are also going to be advocating so for the greater good too, or a social good. They just might be in that business, right? So I think, I'm trying to think of an example that would, you know, we all have telephones, right? So we might, you know, care that our telephone provider might come and tell the city, if you pass a certain law, that's going to impact all of our telephone usage, right? And mm-hmm. and one can say they have this vested interest because they make money, but who's to say that at the end of the day, their advocacy in that one issue has nothing to do with their bottom line, but has to do with everybody having access to a telephone? The same way, you know, nonprofits will come and advocate for, you know, housing for the homeless. They're not going to personally benefit from getting that housing, but they may get a contract from the city to be the provider who's going to coordinate that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So they come before the city because they want to support housing, but at the same time, on the back end, at some point, they might be the partner that ends up administrating, you know, or running that house. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, I'm giving you these opportunities to address it because that's mm-hmm. what we're wrestling with, right? Because, mm-hmm. of course, and everybody knows this was one of my initial questions at the last meeting, was that I do have a natural, who doesn't want to help a 501c3? But mm-hmm. when you take a moment and we start peeling back and we start seeing that a lot of the decisions and a lot of the reasons why people come to the city, it's more than just the good cause that we all care about. Mm-hmm. And I also want to make sure we are transparent that there are moments in time where, for-profit entities are also trying to make our city better for all of us.
Right, and I'm not saying that they're not. What I'm saying is that they're set up different, according to different sets of principles and fiduciary responsibilities, right? So inherently, there are different kinds of organizations. It's not that they're good or bad, right? It's that they're set up differently under law. And so that's one of my points, is that making that distinction under law is not, it's not unconstitutional. It's all, it's, you know, unless you think that all of federal tax law is unconstitutional, that's not an issue. And another thing that I want to say about the staff report is that there's an exception in there, which we don't have an issue with, that if a 501c3 were coming to the city on its own behalf, then it wouldn't be, you know, we would be happy with a blanket, we'd be thrilled with a blanket exemption that had that exception in it. So to the extent that, you know, USC is coming to talk about its land use permits, then that wouldn't apply.
I do want to say I appreciate that you bringing up the IRS code, because I do think that, yes, it does recognize there's a difference in the types of entities, mm-hmm. but I also think there's a recognition in that law that requires some transparency in terms of what the 501c3s are doing, and the fact that they have to disclose and that there's a limit in what they do,
right.
I think also signals to us that at the local level, we have to kind of support that transparency, and so it makes me think, how do we be consistent with that? So, but I think the clear message there is that there is a recognition at the federal level that 501c3s have a limited ability to lobby, and they have to be transparent about what they're doing and how they're using their money.
Right.
And so how do we at the local level, you know, support that?
Right. So based on that status, they're the only tax status that has to do that kind of reporting. I think that, yeah, thank you. I was just going to say that, you know, 501c3s have unique expertise on issues like homelessness, policing, addressing the housing crisis. And because of the legal and fiscal financial constraints on c3s, in order to allow all Angelenos to participate in city government, our reporting systems must recognize that special role, like you said, or risk stacking the system further against the participation of low-income and disadvantaged communities. So thank you.
Thank you for your time. So we're going to finish with public comment, but Mr. Hardy, when you come up, maybe we can focus some attention on this issue of, the fact that 501c3s are highly regulated and how our proposed local changes would be duplicative or different from what's already happening on the federal level, and maybe honing in on the fact that I believe the exemption that we're talking about is specifically for 501c's that provide indigent services free of charge and get government funding, and how many 501c3s that might cover. So I believe Ms. Randois had a colleague from the Alliance for Justice who is going to come up. I also believe we are not adhering to the public comment time, so I will not even hit that today.
And I'm sorry, I can fill out the card. I must have forgotten to do that with my name.
I don't apologize, but I think we're going to need it for the minutes. So I'm going to pass that around.
Hi, good morning. My name is Shyam Subramanian, and I'm Southern California Counsel with Alliance for Justice. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. I wanted to echo my colleague Nona's comments about the unique challenges that 501c3 organizations face and their unique interest and role. And some of these challenges include the cost of the registration fees, understanding whether or not they are exempt under the Curtin Ordinance without hiring an attorney, and administrative difficulties, as Nona's mentioned, in tracking lobbying under different definitions at the city level and the IRS definitions. As we mentioned in our previous meeting, the City of Los Angeles' definition of lobbying activities is broader than the federal definitions that apply to all 501c3 organizations. Deviations between the federal and local definitions force any 501c3 engaged in city decision-making to implement two separate tracking and reporting systems. So in our comments, and there's more detail in the letter, we've provided some proposals to the definition of lobbying activities to align the definition more with the IRS definition to ease the unique burden on 501c3 organizations. Again, these changes may not be necessary if 501c3s are exempt. However, this is another way to ease the burden on 501c3 organizations. So I just wanted to go through a couple of examples. One example is a lobbying activity we recommend not include responding to a written request from a city official for technical advice or assistance on a city matter. What may happen is a 501c3 organization may be reluctant to provide their expertise in response to a request if they know that this would count as a lobbying activity and that they may be required to register as a lobbyist. In addition, we have a proposal for seeking to a proposal that a lobbying activity is not include seeking to influence a third party on a city matter without asking the third party to contact a city official, providing contact information for a city official to a third party, or providing a mechanism such as a petition for a third party to contact a city official.
Sorry, on the last one you just said, I just wanted to, how is that different than providing only objective technical data or specialized knowledge within a particular profession? You don't read that to be that first one?
So I think one of the concerns is that it's not exactly clear in our view what technical advice and assistance as currently defined is. Also, I think there's the component of responding to a written request from a city official. And I think also the fact that this is an IRS definition already provides some context and analysis of what this means. And so 501c3 organizations are familiar with this activity as an exception to lobbying activity that exists at the under IRS rules. And just on the point I was making about influencing a third party, organizations that do try to influence a third party on a city matter without asking them to contact a city official or giving them a mechanism to do so, they may be required to report under the Los Angeles Municipal Lobbying Ordinance, even if they never themselves contact a city official because of the reporting under a major filer. And so these proposals, and there's additional detail, just provide some ways to ease the burden on 501c3 organizations by aligning the definitions more with the IRS definitions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Pritchard, welcome back. Morning. I believe you are our last public comment for the day.
Okay, good. So I'll try to move along quickly then.
No, everybody else is.
Good. Well, thanks for the opportunity.
We're not going to shortchange you.
All right, great. Thank you. My name is Michelle Pritchard. I'm the director of the Common Agenda Program at the Liberty Hill Foundation, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year in serving nonprofits in the Los Angeles County area. Many of the themes I'm only really going to address two themes, and I think Nona did a wonderful job and Sham, too, of engaging in in-depth discussion around them, so I'll try to be brief. The first is that I really did want to urge a more extended and inclusive process to engage the nonprofit sector as you review the current municipal lobbying ordinance. We greatly appreciated that that Nathan Hardy and Mark Lowe reached out to us promptly after the August meeting, as well as the incorporation of several of the key recommendations that we suggested. But I just wanted to say that I had envisioned a more inclusive process when I was here in August. Only 8 organizations have been involved, at least in the working group that Alliance for Justice and Liberty Hill have been involved in. And we had one face-to-face meeting with staff and then one follow-up phone conference. Those groups include Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Cal Nonprofits, the Center for Nonprofit Management, Public Counsel, Community Partners, Inner City Law Center, and then, of course, Liberty Hill and Alliance for Justice. And of course, these are all excellent organizations to provide kind of a bird's eye view of the field. But there is a much larger universe of nonprofits, as you probably well know. I asked Regina at the Center for Nonprofit Management, and she says they estimate about 10,000 nonprofits are actively operating in the Los Angeles County area. So your decisions are going to affect a lot of organizations and a lot of people. And while I know we can't engage all of them, I think we'd be happy to work with you and staff to have a broader outreach that would engage a more diverse and representative sector. For example, arts organizations or environmental groups, you know, thinking about these changes from their perspective is something we should do. So point number 2, I wanted to come back to something that Nona talked about, and that is when nonprofits are pursuing their mission to inform and engage disadvantaged populations and communities in the city of Los Angeles and policymaking, I think they should be considered for an exemption or at least for that activity. As you know, and this affects many groups funded by Liberty Hill, many groups work to improve the social and economic circumstances faced by those low-income communities, not just through service delivery, but through public education and advocacy to change the institutional policies towards greater equity. Again, LA is home to many residents who do not enjoy the same access or privilege or ability to communicate with legislators as compared to more powerful interests who can hire lobbyists or trade associations or PR firms. Our city has a lot of barriers for people, our vast geography, the high rate of poverty of many residents, which prevents them from really doing much more than just working their two or three jobs, many people who are learning English as a second language, and many policy matters are extremely technical and complex and require some interpretation. So many nonprofits spend their time informing and educating and engaging disadvantaged residents to understand the issues and then to raise their own voice in the context of public hearings and meetings. So for me, I really see many nonprofits working to fulfill and support principles of democracy and civic participation and to create some balance in our system. So I think I will pretty much leave it at that. Okay. Please.
Mm-hmm. I just had a question, and I should have also asked the others. What's the real concern for the 501c3s? Because I imagine just by the nature of the mission of these organizations and the democracy, as you mentioned, that you all support the transparency aspect of these laws, so they serve to provide transparency to the public. Right. Is the concern the restrictions that becoming a lobbyist, once you qualify, that what that imposes, or is the concern more around the cost of compliance? Or both?
I think it's probably both. I think that, honestly, I think it's mostly a confusion factor that ends up creating a chilling effect for a lot of nonprofits, so they feel they really can't or shouldn't engage, that it's because the rules are complicated. You have to spend time to read them and understand them and then think about how they apply in your context. So when, you know, we have provided trainings for our grantees, which the Alliance for Justice does a wonderful job, but I have to say, you see how many people kind of walk out and go, wow, you know, I didn't know I have to do all of that. And so I think that's our main concern, that it really prevents nonprofits from exercising their right, you know, to lobby under the law. Again, the IRS permits it within very clearly prescribed limits. Most nonprofits are able to track that and understand what that is, but having an entirely separate regimen from the city, I think, creates a dampener on wanting to participate at all.
Do you support the blanket exception?
I do. I think that there is a fundamental difference in why nonprofits form. I think the work that they do does not directly benefit, in most cases, the staff or the board members or the funders of those nonprofits. The work is benefiting populations that need to have a more equal playing field in life and in participating in city decision-making. So that's my perspective.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So just to also give you a chance to then respond to one of my questions. So on the transparency side, mm-hmm. how do you think then that the need or the role that these organizations plays outweighs the need for us to have transparency in terms of who lobbies our government?
Well, I think that the nonprofit sector provides an invaluable service to the city. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. It's huge, you know, particularly in the face of so many government cutbacks in services and other activities. You know, nonprofits have picked up a lot of the slack. So I think it's really vital that we protect their interests. And
so you think that they would know, if we were to maintain these laws, mm-hmm. that they wouldn't be able to fulfill their mission, that they wouldn't be able to continue to do their work?
I think it becomes more burdensome to do that. It becomes more burdensome. I should also say that, you know, and while I don't think this is probably a problem for many, private foundation funds cannot be used to support lobbying activities. So, you know, again, an organization would have to have the sophistication and the internal accounting systems to make sure that those lobby hours are not getting charged to private foundation grants, but are instead being charged unrestricted. So, you know, there's a lot of technical follow-through that would be required or is currently required by the LAMLO.
And if an exemption was impossible, would you guys be able to come with that, come to us with some kind of recommendations around compliance and costs?
I think that we can do that and have already done so, and I think staff has certainly heard us on some of these issues. So I think the next step would be to think in terms of types of nonprofits and then, of course, what constitutes lobbying activity, you know, reviewing the actual work that we are going to categorize that way.
So thank you.
That would be, I think, the next step.
I'm wrestling with with part of Commissioner DeHaan's question about transparency, and I want to ask you. I feel like what you're asserting is not necessarily a matter of nonprofits not having a willingness to be transparent in what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So do you have an idea of how nonprofits could still create the same level of transparency without it, with there still being an exemption to a certain extent of nonprofits related to the MLO?
Well, I think that's probably a longer discussion, and I haven't thought about it a lot, Commissioner Oberstein, but I think that, you know, nonprofits have to do a fair amount of reporting, not just to the IRS and to the state of California, but to their donors. You know, there's a lot, and most funders want to look at the tax returns. They want to look at the website. They want to meet the staff. So I think that there's a lot of transparency already that the nonprofit sector is subject to. I'm not sure, you know, beyond that, what more I would say without, you know, thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where I would really love as this collaboration continues, because I think that's what all of us on the commission want to see happening, more dialogue before we get to whatever's finalized. But I think that, you know, I'm going to push back on staff. But the way I've pushed back on you guys, if you felt that I was pushing back on you, and what I would ask of you guys to do for us to help us is tell us where you guys can help us with the transparency issue. Okay. How can we, because I think that's our most important, one of our most important jobs here on the Ethics Commission is to provide transparency. And so we understand how regulations may, you know, impact different organizations differently. So how do we keep transparency? And my initial thoughts, just kind of reviewing everything, is that there may be some flexibility around obviously what triggers compliance, also around the costs, right? The registration fees, what we can do to streamline our processes to make it easier for everybody to comply with the law so it's not as expensive for not just nonprofits, but also for the for-profits, if you will. And then finally, another concern that I don't know if you guys, you know, once you get there, then there's these restrictions. And you guys haven't talked about whether or not these restrictions are even an issue for 501c3s, but if they are, if they aren't, I want to know. Because once you become a lobbyist, then there's this other side that you can't do. And so I don't know if that's also an issue or not.
Right.
So that's what I think would help us flush this out.
Okay, good. So we'll do some more thinking about that as we go forward with this. Good.
Thank you for the time.
Okay,
thanks
very much.
Mr. Sutton has a quick follow-up.
Not as much. Just a few points. First of all, the burdens, the cost, the compliance, those apply just as much to 501c4s and 501c6s, which oftentimes do not have as large budgets because their donations are not tax deductible. So it's to the extent this is about a burden on compliance and cost, that's not just C3s. Second of all, I think your point was very important. Registration and reporting is not a barrier to lobbying, and that's what the speaker seemed to be implying. It's just registration and reporting. The other, I think, piece of misinformation about, well, C3s have this dual tracking system, well, so do for-profit entities. Because, and trust me, the federal lobbying law, the federal tax law, the local lobbying laws, it is craziness. For-profit entities can't deduct money spent on lobbying under entirely different definitions. So for-profit entities have to track that and also have to track local lobbying compliance. So they have the same dual tracking issue. And I'm going to conclude with an idea, a suggestion, but I think what happened today is a reason why it's not appropriate for the public to exempt C3s. If there were a blanket C3 exception, the people who were lobbying for this exemption would not have to file reports, and the public wouldn't know that they were lobbying, whereas the lobby association would. And I think the lobbying law is about giving information to the public about who is influencing City Hall decisions and how. And again, I think what happened today is an example of why it would not be at all fair to exempt C3s. So the answer is not exempting any type of entity because of their mission statement. It's making the reporting requirements more streamlined. The City of Los Angeles' reporting requirements have been added on over the years. One of the reasons why we're here, the Lobby Association sent in 17 questions about the lobbying reporting requirements almost 7 or 8 years ago. And 3 years later, the staff still couldn't answer the questions because that's how bad the reporting law was. If the reporting requirements are straightforward, I think they could be done on one page. What's your organization? What are you lobbying on? Which city agencies did you contact? And which city officials? Forget about what percentage of the salary of the employees. If it's a simple one-page form, then it's not a barrier for entry. The public has information, right? Everyone knows who's lobbying, and no one can really claim it's a burden. So that's the answer, streamline reporting, not blanket exemptions. Thank you for the additional time.
You were going to say that. Thank you, Mr. Sun. We have a resident from Encino first, and then that will be the last response.
Sorry, I know I kind of kicked this off with all my questions. I'll just say that I hope and I think it'll streamline our discussion because now you should know where to go.
I think you're okay. We'll
go first. Good. Wayne from Encino. So the hardest commission to find in America. There it is. This commission is exactly like a revolving crap game. It just picks up and moves around. You do your meeting the same exact time as the council downstairs. Nobody can get to these meetings. There's so many activists that want to come here and talk about this stuff, but you cancel, you reschedule, you hold these at 10 a.m. So it starts with transparency. Hold these meetings when we actually can get to them. That's a good start to transparency. But also what's got all of you upset is all the coverage of a certain police officer that you're lynching who had to retire, that's a whistleblower, and he's got a $10,000 fine that you're trying to give him for releasing a tape. A tape. He released a tape exonerating the department from racial discrimination, yet you're taking action to impose a $10,000 ethics fine against former Sergeant Parker. Now, Parker's not going to come here and speak. His attorney's not going to come here and speak.
He's not on the agenda.
It's the issue of transparency. You're not having transparency when you take a whistleblower and you punish a whistleblower with financial penalties. Okay, meanwhile, where's Tom LaBonge? Tom LaBonge has destroyed thousands of pages of city filings. Have you started a case against him?
On the agenda. This is not a matter on the
agenda. Well, you brought up the issue of transparency. See, now when I talk about transparency, now I get interrupted and I get excuses for people saying I'm not on the topic. See, you don't want transparency. What you want is pseudo-transparency. You want to have these people come in with 501c3s, 501c4s, go to Herb Wesson, pay them indirectly through campaign donations and get grants and funnel the money back into the system. Now, that doesn't mean a goddamn thing. What you need to do is dismiss the case against Parker and show us transparency. Until you do that, you have none.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Randall.
Yes.
Sorry, I'll be very brief, but just in terms of transparency, 501c3s already have transparency. We already are highly regulated and reporting, so let us provide you with the same reports that we're already providing to the federal government, and that would be a good way of balancing that. Encouraging additional reporting under different sets of standards is really chilling participation of C3s in city government.
So we could,
and it really challenges the funding that C3s get because of the perception of lobbying. None of us in this room think that lobbying is bad. We think participating in government is a good thing, but unfortunately, the public doesn't necessarily feel the same way, and so that label is a chilling factor to 501c3 participation.
So we could put those reports potentially on our website then? You guys would agree to any 501c3 would, in essence, as a condition of falling under the exemption, we can just put them on the ethics website and say, this organization is going to engage city government, and here's their Form 90, and we'll put that on the city ethics website.
That sounds good to me, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Hardy. So first I want to say, thank you to the staff. I know that you've quickly reached out to stakeholders in the community. I think that we're talking about a couple of different buckets of items here, and the first is the big change, I think, is the change in going from a time-based manner to a compensation-based. And I think that really the question for the compensation is kind of where do we hit that right line, because we're trying to balance not being overly burdensome and not asking people to, before they put on their socks in the morning, to file a report with the city of Los Angeles, but we're also trying to provide the public with important information. And so I understand it's very kind of hard to hit that right amount. And then in the other kind of set of buckets that we're talking about, I think that and that's where we're getting the public comments, there's a lot of discussion about what to do with these 501c3s, which are, as we've discussed, highly regulated, and we do treat them differently than other C3s. We treat them differently from other for-profits. We treat them differently from natural people. We treat them differently from LLCs for a host of reasons. So I want to go on record saying my understanding is that by definition of how we define C3s versus C4s versus C5s, we absolutely do decide to treat them differently. And in fact, we decide to even say at times, you are allowed to say this if you're a C3. You are allowed to say this if you're a C4. Having said that, I think that there has been a good discussion about the need to treat C3s in some way differently because, and I want to hone in on, we're talking about C3s that get government funding, and we're talking about C3s that provide services for indigent clients. Is that correct? Because which is essentially all C3s.
Sure, I'm happy to clarify. And good morning, commissioners. Just for the record, my name is Nathan Hardy, Director of Policy for the Los Angeles City Ethics Commission. President Levinson, as you point out, there are several issues that arose during the public comment, and it's important to clarify those to guide our discussion.
And just one other thing I wanted. So we're not talking about no disclosure versus more disclosure. So every nonprofit organization that needs to report to the federal government does have to engage in some reporting. The question is whether they have to do additional reporting or different reporting from us. I believe that's what we're talking about, because it's not like you become a C3 and you're kind of, you go about your business and we never hear from you again. I think that there are certainly concerns about C3s and, more importantly, C4s that kind of are sheeps in wolf's clothing and act as political committees because we have this really bizarre, substantial test on the federal level. But talking about lobbying, I believe, is somewhat separate. So maybe we can focus our discussion on what would be additional that we're asking C3s to do here.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. And just to clarify, the current exemption that exists in the MLO applies to 501c3 organizations that receive government funding and provide services directly to the indigent free of charge. This is an exemption that has historically existed, at least in my knowledge, I think as far back as 1999. In our conversations with local representatives from the 501c3 community, one of the things that they've made very clear to us is that the current language in the exemption doesn't necessarily match the realities that a lot of 501c3 organizations are facing, especially since the recession. And that a lot of 501c3 organizations, in fact, have to charge sometimes nominal fees in order to provide their services or to stay afloat financially. So what we are proposing in our set of staff recommendations is to slightly expand the 501c3 categorical exemption that currently exists in the law so that it more accurately reflects the realities facing these nonprofit organizations. And what that would do is exempt entirely organizations that are created to provide direct social services to disadvantaged persons, whether it's free of charge or at a below market rate or for a nominal fee. So what that means is that these organizations, were they to lobby on behalf of a matter of particular importance for their organization, they would not be subject to regulation at all under the MLO unless they're seeking city funding or city property on their own behalf. That's where we think it would be important to draw the line. Another,
or if it's an issue not related to their organization, or not.
Heather, would you like to jump?
Yes, if they're not acting in their capacity as advocates for the disadvantaged community, then it would apply.
But how do you guys define, I feel like that's kind of nebulous, right? So, like, if I'm in housing, if I'm a nonprofit that does housing, and somebody's coming in on food services, that's tangentially related, right? Or not?
Probably not. If their organization is formed around housing issues and not anything else, then that would not be part of their direct purpose.
So I have a question, just thinking about a housing organization may be an education organization for communities not providing housing, right? So maybe it's an education organization, maybe it's out in the community or partnering with organizations that do provide housing. If they're providing some kind of funding or enabling them to advertise, are they're not doing a direct service, so then they would also not be under this exemption. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct.
So right now we have an exemption for those who receive government money to provide these services. That's one universe, right? And then is there also a discussion then to widen that to just any 501c3, or we're okay with just, we're just worried about this group?
So we've spent a lot of time at the staff level discussing this issue, and we've had the opportunity to meet with local representatives from the 501c3 community at the request to discuss some of these issues. And I think they've greatly informed our staff recommendations. And to go back to your question, Commissioner DeHaan, as the exemption currently stands, right, it's very, very limited. There's two prongs that you have to meet: receiving government funding, and then providing services to indigent persons free of charge. And as we stated in our discussions with the 501c3 community, what they communicated to us is that that really isn't reflecting the current realities. The organizations that we had in mind in our proposed categorical exemption is organizations that provide direct social services, whether it be legal, health, sometime, or you know, there are groups that, say, take the example of a homeless shelter. If a homeless shelter, is clearly an organization that provides direct social services to disadvantaged individuals. If that homeless shelter would wanted to go and meet with city council members to discuss new legislative proposals to try and tackle the homelessness crisis that we have here in the city of Los Angeles, that would be something that we would consider a categorically exempt activity because of the type of organization that they are, because of the activity in which they're involved. so that organization would be entirely exempt as long as they're not seeking city funding or property.
Let's say that somebody, just going back to what Commissioner DeHaan said, somebody from who provides food services mm-hmm. joins in that housing meeting. Would they then have to register, even though their clientele it's probably the same clientele, but it's not their direct mission, they would then have to report lobbying specifically for that action?
Yes.
So I'm just trying to make sure I understand the scope of what we're discussing, because I there already is exemption. Your staff is not recommending that we get rid of that one exemption. But we are hearing from the nonprofit community, and I feel like it's kind of blurring, so I'm trying to understand. Are they asking us to expand that exemption? Is that what's being asked of us, or are they just trying to maintain the existing exemption?
So what the representatives from the local nonprofit community have communicated to us is a preference for a blanket categorical exemption.
So expand it beyond the nonprofit that you've
right.
identified. Okay. And your concern with that expansion is?
Our concern is transparency. We want to make sure that we are advocating for a transparent and accountable set of lobbying laws that provides an accurate picture of the lobbying activity that is currently occurring in the city of Los Angeles. I think one important point to note is that there's been a lot of discussion of overlap between federal law, between local reporting requirements, and I think it's important to note that they do serve distinct purposes. Under federal law, there are certain limitations on lobbying activities for 501c3 organizations because of the extremely favorable tax treatment that they get under federal law. The MLO and the city lobbying laws do not limit lobbying. They simply require disclosure. And for the reasons that have arisen in the public comments and in this discussion, I think it highlights the importance of striking the right balance. We continue to believe that our proposal does just that.
As a newcomer, can you tell me, under the current MLO, how many nonprofits are currently registered? You know, we've talked about having eight entities conferring with us, mm-hmm. And then we've talked about thousands of other entities out there. What's the scope of the numbers of people, and what problems or abuses have we seen in the past?
To answer your question, Commissioner Ordon, we don't currently have I don't have that specific data available for you today. That's something that we could certainly get.
Nathan is correct. He doesn't have that particular information, and I'm just only interrupting him because, for the record, I'm Mark Lowe. I'm the lobbying program manager, and I have more experience in the day-to-day registration and reporting functions that these organizations have to comply with our organization. Currently, we don't break out 501c3s apart from the lobbying employers that we classify them as. I will say that for 2016, there are approximately 70 lobbyist employers that file with the city. Lobbyist employers are organizations that have that employ lobbyists who lobby only on their behalf. So that can be, for example, the biggest one are investment fund managers. They have employees that lobby the city pension systems. Also in this group of lobbyist employers include organizations like AIDS Project LA, which is a 501c3, or you know, different health organizations, the Hospital Association of Southern California. Different organizations may be 501c3s. However, we do not ask on the registration and reporting laws for them to designate that they are, in fact, a 501c3. So we don't keep that type of information on record.
Can I ask, how long have these nonprofits been subject to this requirement?
As long as we've had the lobbying laws that distinguished lobbying firms from lobbyist employers, and that goes back quite a ways.
Has anything changed? I mean, I guess I'm wondering, like, I mean, they've all been functioning. What's triggering? Is it just because we're having the discussion, or has something happened that's triggered this new concern of the chilling effect.
Yeah, I think this conversation is triggered by the fact that we're engaging in this comprehensive review of the lobbying laws. But ever since the city has had a lobbying law, which dates back to 1967, nonprofit organizations, just like any other entity that might employ in-house or contract lobbyists, has been subject to the laws. In 1999, is that when the current exemption was added into the law as a statement that the city believes that the services that these particular kinds of nonprofits provide are valuable enough that we will not require them to register and report in the same way that other nonprofits and other for-profit organizations would have to do. But I don't believe that there's any new concern externally motivated. This is an internally motivated conversation because we're bringing this forward.
If there were somebody who worked for the city of Los Angeles and left to go become an executive director of a nonprofit, under sort of what Mr. Sutton was bringing up, that oftentimes the executive directors are the people who are meeting directly with our elected officials, if the mission of their organization was not direct services, but sort of under the umbrella of working with indigenous communities, would they then be prohibited from meeting with elected officials for their first year after leaving the city?
Yes, they would be, but that's not a part of the lobbying law. That's part of the governmental ethics law. It's the revolving door provisions, and it would apply regardless of what organization they were working for, nonprofit or for-profit.
Even as an executive director, no. Really? That's mm-hmm. not, I didn't mm-hmm. realize that.
Yeah.
Okay. So just a housekeeping question. Do we have a time limitation on one of our commissioners? Did I hear that someone needs to go at a certain time?
I need to leave soonish.
Okay. So let me just ask a kind of housekeeping question, which is, it sounds like we're not at a resolution place right now. So what's the best thing to do going forward? Because I know that we probably don't want to continue to conceptually approve until 2036. So if you could walk us through, because I'm not sure that we're going to get to a, here's the exact language we need, and I want Vice President,
501c3 or on everything?
Well, everything. And I don't think we want to parse it.
Right. We actually wouldn't propose specific language until all of the discussions are concluded and we know what the recommendations are conceptually. But yes, you're right. We would like some solid groundwork to stand on as we proceed and do start to talk about things like registration and reporting and other kinds of things that are part of the lobbying laws. But probably if you're wanting to wrap up the discussion today fairly quickly, it would be helpful for us to hear what you think the law should look like, and we can take that back as a staff and assess that. For example, the proposal of posting Form 990s on our website, we would really need to look into that because Form 990 is not designed to provide robust disclosure to Los Angelinos. So we would need some time to evaluate whether that would serve the purposes of disclosure for our citizens.
Or we could link to a place where you can find
990s. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Easier, and going through a 990 is
exactly
a different animal.
Yes, but again, the concern from the part of the staff, not the concern, but the balancing act for the staff is the purpose of this law is not to say anybody can't talk. As far as we're concerned, even if you're a nonprofit, you can spend 100% of your time in lobbying. That's not what this law does. That's a separate federal law that might limit that. So all we are talking about is providing the public with the best information that they should have in terms of knowing how their public dollars are being spent and how the government decisions are being made. And that requires disclosure by all parties involved in a particular issue, not just those on one particular side or the other. So that is our goal in making recommendations to you, is something that is as equitable as possible while at the same time recognizing the realities that this law does impose work and obligations on those who are regulated by it, and not wanting to go to one extreme or the other on either front.
President Levins, if I can make a recommendation, it seems like some of the issues that come up with the 501c3 thing, we can, I think staff can come up with different kind of proposals on how to address them, but it seems like the fundamental issue that we have to get consensus on, and we may not be able to do today, is whether or not, I'm trying to frame this in a way that's not biased, but ultimately it's whether or not we think the exemption should be expanded. Because if we don't think it needs to be expanded, that doesn't mean the conversation stops. It means that we might still be able to address some of the concerns raised by the 501c3s who don't already exist under the exemption. And then we can talk about ways on how to address some of those concerns.
And just to clarify, the staff is recommending expanding the current exemption, just not applying it to every 501c3,
right,
regardless of purpose.
Right. Well, yeah, that's what I was trying to, define what that expansion universe looks like, mm-hmm, so that we could then conceptually agree or disagree whether or not we want it to be wider or not.
Okay, so
And to make it a little more complicated,
yes,
I do think the exemption and the size of the exemption is so inextricably,
yes,
linked,
yes,
to what they have to do once they're in the system.
Yeah,
I mean, as others have talked before, it's not very onerous, and it doesn't really mean anything, and maybe it's not even called lobbyist, it's called legislative advocate or something that people can stand to say about themselves, then, you know, you look at it a different way. So I don't know how you can do too much with the exemption,
yeah,
before you find out what being in the system means to,
yeah,
the entity.
I think there are inextricably linked.
Well, and I also think we kind of jumped to two, but the first one, the switch from the time versus compensation,
right,
may automatically eliminate this because, right, not to, you know, to somewhat preview what you already saw from the last meeting, my concerns about the 2000 threshold being kind of low, but I do see that that threshold can also be a way that will inoculate this 501c3 issue if we develop a threshold that's, you know, not based on the entity, but rather really trying to get to the kind of transparency that we're looking for.
Did we explore any of the what Mr. Sutton provided, which are the San Francisco and San Diego methods of registering lobbyists?
Yes, Commissioner Herbst. I've been in contact with several ethics commissions from New York City to San Diego, San Francisco, Chicago. I've had detailed policy discussions with their staff, with their legal counsels, and various city attorneys' office. So those are systems that we have considered. The reason that we're proposing the system that we are is that we believe that lobbying is done by individuals, not firms, and it's ultimately the individual person-to-person contacts that the public wants disclosure of. We think it's important that a registration threshold track as closely as possible the type of activity that we want disclosure of. And we believe that an annual registration threshold of $2,000 does just that. It also creates a clear, bright-line rule that can apply to any individual in any organization, which we believe helps to ensure compliance, transparency, and accountability.
I wanted to mention, too, just to clarify for the record, I think what was mentioned in the letter is that San Diego and San Francisco base their systems on what is paid to a lobbying firm and not to an individual who's engaged in lobbying. That's true in San Diego. It's actually not true in San Francisco. They changed their lobbying law in February of this year, and what they communicated to us was that it was very difficult to track who was supposed to register, and it applied the lobbying laws inequitably to the individuals who are engaged in the activities by attributing the firm's activity to the individuals who are actually engaged in the lobbying. And the vast majority of jurisdictions that we have encountered and looked at, excuse me, do have a lobbyist-based system, and that's because lobbying has to happen between people. An entity doesn't lobby without the people who are involved, and so that's why historically our law has been structured the way that it is and why the vast majority of other jurisdictions structure it in that way. So San Francisco is not in the same category as San Diego.
I just, going back to the issue of, you know, if transparency and if what is going to be of interest to the public probably does have to do more with who they're meeting with and what issues they're meeting on versus someone in the general public has probably very little notion of what $2,000 means to a lobbyist or 30 hours of their time. And somebody who doesn't track their time or is irresponsible about reporting their time, I just have a hard time believing that they're going to be responsible about reporting their money as well. So that's where the question is coming from, if there is some kind of more refined or reductive way to get to this.
Are you suggesting that a compensation-based threshold would not be a better approach? Are you concerned about a compensation-based
threshold? I'm concerned about first the low threshold, but then also, you know,
counting of the hours, right? Exactly. So how do you get to 2,000? You have to know your hourly rate.
Exactly. It's the same. It seems like it's a trade-off, and that $2,000 is still based on an hourly rate. And if the person isn't monitoring their hours, then they're not monitoring.
Well, this is a perfect example.
Is it necessarily based upon an hourly rate?
No, it's not.
As Mr. Sutton talked about, it could be a fee. So.
Exactly. So this is the perfect example of how one size fits all doesn't apply. Right. With any kind of lobbying scheme, you do the very best that you can for your jurisdiction, and you have to kind of deal with the nebulousness on some areas and the imperfections in other areas. And this is one of those examples. In our experience, not all lobbyists are engaged on an hourly basis. Mm-hmm. There are some who are paid by project. So this is the issue that I want pushed forward, and I will pay you $5,000 to get this issue through. So those individuals would know that they're entitled to receive $5,000. They would hit the threshold. It wouldn't be a matter of calculating hours. A couple of other points to make on that front are that there isn't a requirement, even under the proposal, that people track their hours. We have a number of lobbyists who know they're going to be lobbying all year, so they register at the beginning of the year. They get it done with. They don't have to track anything. Right. So that's one option. If they do want to track their dollars down to the penny, then there is some work involved with that. But again, this is a law that's designed to promote transparency and to inform the public, and there's just some steps that have to be taken if that's going to get accomplished.
But isn't this actually the issue Commissioner Oberstein is raising? Isn't it really about in-house, whether it be in-house for-profit or in-house nonprofit, right? Because it's true that a lobbyist – look, I think people who are lobbyists have swallowed the pill. They're going to register. That's not a problem. The concern is when you're an in-house employee at whatever type of organization, for-profit or nonprofit, and how do they, as an in-house employee, figure out this 2,000 amount? In essence, they have to look at their hours. I mean, there's no other way to do it, right, unless there is.
Well, I'd be happy to speak to the in-house issue. I myself worked as an attorney in an in-house corporation, and I think I'd be happy to speak to that. I think the important thing about a compensation-based standard is that it does create this clear, bright-line rule for individuals working in an in-house organization. If they're devoting a substantial amount of time to lobbying activities, to lobbying city officials, it's going to be pretty clear based on a compensation threshold, we believe, whether they're going to meet that or not. The circumstances in which you might have to look at your hours, those are going to be really concerning. The examples, you know, that aren't so clear. But I think it's important to think about some of the points that were made as far as what an in-house contacts-based standard could present. Because one of the principal arguments that we heard in favor of it was that if we had a compensation-based standard for in-house lobbyist registration, that certain individuals such as CEOs or business executives could be required to register for very little activity, for perhaps one phone call, because they make so much money. It's our concern that that kind of rule would, in fact, create a double standard, that it would say that CEOs and wealthy business executives can play by a different set of rules than everybody else, and that's something that we fundamentally disagree.
I mean, that probably wasn't a good example, but I would be more concerned about the flip side, particularly if we're looking at the nonprofits, right? So we're talking – most nonprofits aren't going to be paying that much, and so you would have these employees who who a lot of times nonprofits have an employee that does like three different functions, right? And if they have to track their hours on things that qualify under this to reach 2,000, but yet they probably, you know, maybe 2,000 of their salary is a larger portion because they're not getting paid that much. Mm. And on top of that, now they're tracking hours when their function is to maybe do this one project, you know, X amount of time out of the year, but they also do a whole bunch of other things for the nonprofit. I think that's kind of what we're trying to understand in terms, and that's where that 2,000 mark seems to be mm-hmm. too low. I think we could address this issue if it was a little higher. So could you speak to why we're still at 2,000?
Absolutely. And I thank you for asking that question because it is important in getting this right to answer that question. So at the last meeting, staff was asked to provide some additional context regarding how we arrived at this $2,000 threshold. So what we did is we looked at the data that we currently have available, which is payments received by lobbying firms and payments made by lobbying firm clients last year in 2015. When we looked at that data, we actually found that 25.21%, it's more than a quarter, all lobbying firm clients actually reported spending less than $5,000 on lobbying services last year. In fact, 15% of all lobbying firm clients reported spending less than $2,000 on lobbying firm services. As a result of looking at that data, we had concerns at the staff level that perhaps raising that threshold might not accurately capture all of the lobbying activity that is currently occurring in the city, and continue to feel that $2,000 strikes the right balance because it would capture most of the lobbying activity that occurs in the city without imposing an undue burden on those subject to the law, and also reinforce the concept that exists elsewhere in city law, that $2,000 constitutes significant spending and an amount in which the public has an interest in knowing.
So my only concern with this data was that, it doesn't address the in-house issue, which is where all this kind of pops up for us, whether it's the 501c3s or it's, you know, mm-hmm. I think there's also a growing trend that a lot of for-profit organizations are starting to do a lot of in-house lobby, you know, there's in-house lobbyist positions. And so this data doesn't necessarily reflect that because I don't know how you capture the 70 organizations that he mentioned earlier, right? So there's 70... they're lobbyist employers. This wouldn't capture that because this captures what's paid to a firm, not what's paid internally, right?
That's correct, Mr. DeHaan. And I think what you're pointing out, I think, really reflects the limitations of the current reporting structure that we have in the law. The MLO does not currently require lobbyists to report the payments they receive for lobbying activities. So for that reason, the data doesn't precisely match what our proposed threshold would be. However, we do believe that it provides helpful context just to paint a picture of how much people are paying for lobbying services. And for that reason, we thought it would be helpful.
The issue is here that if you're a lobbying firm, you're going to end up registering, I think, at some point, because in general, that's what you do all the time. Sure. We're trying to make sure there's more disclosure and transparency. So we're trying to figure out how our system can fairly capture people who don't just do this on the regular basis, right? Whose job this isn't. But we're trying to balance that out with there's going to be some people that do it maybe, you know, one day out of the entire year, which is different, I think, than people who do it on a regular basis and get compensated for it and where that money's coming from.
Or similarly to Commissioner Martinez, when we know that there's an ongoing issue, but we're not asking her to divest. If there's an ongoing issue and so a nonprofit has to continuously show up to something, that it's not necessarily that they're a lobbying organization or this is a lobbying employee, but that they have an ongoing interest that is not going away, but it's...
Because it just might be scheduling of city meetings, exactly. Require them to drag it on versus... You know, an entity that's always going to be coming back because this is an issue that they're working on.
Right. But this is another important point to mention with regard to the proposed threshold is that it has to be looked at in terms of the bigger picture of more definitions than simply who is a lobbyist. And that's one of the new recommendations in this report addresses that to a very significant degree. a very lengthy list of activities would be exempt and would not need to be counted toward that $2,000 threshold because they're activities that have a level of objectivity to them. They're conducted in public. They're not the standard kind of behind closed doors kinds of interactions that the public does not have any other way of finding out about. So the $2,000 in combination with that list of exemptions continues to create a solid reporting scheme. And the dollar threshold, again, to the question of equity, whether you are a traditional lobbyist who works for a law firm or has your own business, or someone who is employed in-house at a corporation, a nonprofit, whatever the entity is, dollars are the equalizer. We don't care who you are. We don't care what organization you work for. We don't care what your pet project is or if you're going to be working on it for 1 month or for 27 months. If there is a certain amount of money that is being put into the system as a result of your activity, then we believe that the public has an interest in knowing about that so that they can hold their public officials accountable. There are groups that have issues that are, for whatever reason, before the city council for a very lengthy period of time, and some that are wrapped up in what seems like lightning speed. So that is something that can't really be controlled for in all circumstances. So the equity comes in with applying the same dollar threshold regardless of who you are or where you stand.
I think that's fair, and I appreciate the exemptions, but then I go to like gathering information, right? I mean, you can spend a lot of time gathering information, and I don't think that that's necessarily the kind of disclosure that the public wants, right? I think that the concern is really about that those interactions with city governments, and whether you're a nonprofit or a for-profit, it doesn't matter. It just, I mean, you can spend a lot. You can spend $2,000 worth of a salary in a week, I think, trying to get information sometimes. So, or conducting your research investigations. I mean, I just think that that's why 2,000 seems very low.
But that's just engaging in research would not make someone qualify as a lobbyist. You would also have to then engage in a direct communication with an official that's not exempt as a result of or based on that research.
Is there a balancing factor then? Because I could easily see the same person who researched do that one interaction. So does that automatically trigger it or is there?
That's the only scenario in which it would trigger it. If one person is doing the research and somebody else is having the direct communication, then the person who engaged in only research would not qualify as a lobbyist. And the reason that including things like that in the definition of lobbying activities continues to be important, that's in the law now, and the reason that continues to be important is that if the dollar threshold were based only on the direct communications, then it could be 90 seconds to send an email, or it would be from the time you pick up the phone receiver to the time you hang up, and it would take you can engage in a lot of behind-the-scenes lobbying activity for $2,000 if just the direct communications were the only things that were counted.
So I know we're losing Vice President Oberstein, and I know that she wants to – I think this is a discussion that's important enough that we need the full commission. However, I'm worried that we have no concrete marching orders for you, Mr. Hardy. I would say that I think the list of exemptions is extraordinarily helpful in not capturing what I think my fellow commissioners are worried about, which is essentially people that have a quick touch with the city government and then all of a sudden become lobbyists. And my understanding is looking at it that there's a lot of activity that can be done without kind of ensnaring you in the city regulations. So having said all of that, I'm not sure that we've come to a resolution in terms of what to ask you to do at this point. I think that my personal belief is that moving to this system of compensation with a large and generous list of exclusions makes a lot of sense. Whether or not this is the exact dollar amount that's right, I will kind of I've also spoken to people in San Francisco and San Diego and know that you've done more than your due diligence and understand that there are differences in different jurisdictions. I tend to feel comfortable with this proposal. I tend to feel comfortable with the idea that 501c3s need to have an exemption, and that the reasons that we are undertaking this review is because they had an exemption and we're thinking about what works and what doesn't. And I think that the what I view as a fairly incremental and minor expansion also makes sense. I, however, am not sure if my fellow commissioners are on the same page. So maybe we can kind of go down the line, because I know Commissioner Oberstein has already given us more of her time than she thought she could have.
So as far as the first proposal about the $2,000, I am comfortable with that. And I probably am going to be parting with some of my commissioners. I, at this point, would support a blanket exemption.
Okay. Okay.
I'm still interested in exploring a higher monetary threshold. I could be comfortable with a blanket exemption. I'm also interested in what Mr. Subramanian, I hope I said your last name right, he sent us a list looking at organizations and nonprofits that have a cap at around $7.5 million, which is still considered a small nonprofit. So I'd be interested in exploring that more. I think that's, I do think that the exemption does need to be expanded, because organizations who solely do direct services do not, I don't feel, cover the breadth of the nonprofits that I think should be protected by this.
Surprise, I'd like the 2,000 to be higher. In terms of the 501c3s, I could be comfortable with an exemption if we received legal advice from Renee saying that that was not going to subject the city to any lawsuits on a content-based regulation. So if we got the approval that this was constitutional, or we had a good argument to prove that it was constitutional, I could potentially support a wider exemption. Absent that, I would then say we would need to look at other ways to help nonprofits and for-profits. I mean, in general, I'm sure this is coming down the line, but looking at the fees. And then also, we're having this conversation not considering the restrictions being a lobby, once you're registered, what that triggers. So I'd also want to know how this exemption would impact some of those restrictions and whether it's an issue or not.
I need to know a lot more about linkage before I'm going to be very comfortable. But I certainly agree that, as someone who was a lawyer in both public and private practice, the $2,000 figure does seem low to me. Idea of what is and the balance that you struck for the exemptions, I thought that makes all the sense in the world. But the more exemptions you have and the more difficult they are to define, I think is putting that onerous burden back on the registrant. I like the idea of giving us the menu of perhaps a direct exemption. I like even better the idea that making it really easy and non-onerous and just getting the information out to the public, for both public and both private and nonprofit, it would be even better. So obviously staff has done a terrific job and has been looking at an enormous amount of alternatives, but I'm not very comfortable yet saying I think I know where it's coming out.
Could I ask, for those who think that the $2,000 threshold is too low, what feels like a better threshold to you in terms of helping the staff to focus its discussions between now and December?
Have here, others that have gone to 5,000. Mm-hmm. Another one that has gone to 5,000. That is a large metropolitan entity. So I think you know that would be something that sounds as if there's some interest in that. I also liked people talking about being able to use duplicate filings, something that was in the federal area. But it sounds like those are apples and oranges. I mean, there's nothing about the 990 to me that seems to answer what we're about.
Sorry, and I didn't mean that as a – what I was really trying to get to was I wanted – I think the goal for me is the transparency. So there had been some commitment to the transparency. So I was trying to figure out, just in terms of the bottom line, the commitment to transparency. So I think, I mean, that might be something else. If we're going to do this exemption, how can we still preserve transparency? It's not going to be the 990, but is it going to be, in order to qualify for this exemption, you have to submit a paper that says you're asking for it, and we post that, so at least the public knows everybody who qualifies under the exemption. I don't know.
All right, we have to excuse Commissioner Oberstein. Thank you.
Thank you. One other thing I would just say before going is that maybe the threshold is not for a year period, not for an annual period, but maybe it's a shorter period, like something like quarterly.
Yeah.
Thank you, and I'm sorry I have to go.
No.
And can I just provide one other frame of context, which is not – it's just to help people understand the world that we're operating in. The statement that a small public charity is one that has annual $7.5 million on an annual basis, that's more than twice the budget for the Ethics Commission. So I just throw that out there, mm-hmm. just to provide some context for the world that, you know, we're having to look at this from a holistic perspective.
I agree with that.
Okay. Mr. Hardy, Mr. Liu, with those thoughts in mind, do we feel comfortable? I'm very loath to ask you to kind of continue to go back and go back again, but my hope is that we're honing in on something. So does the commission feel comfortable with conceptually approving essentially what we just have asked Mr. Liu and Mr. Hardy to do? And is this, I mean, let's have a moment. Is this, do you know what we're asking? Do we know what we're asking you? Do you know what we're asking you to do? And is this realistic? I mean, do you feel like December 6th, you're going to come back and we're going to have something that we can say, okay, this section is done? Because I think that's the goal here.
Well, I think it depends on what kind of threshold the commission, at least three of the commissioners, are going to feel comfortable with. So what I'm hearing is that $2,000 isn't going to work for three of the five. So we need to come up with a bigger dollar value. And so $5,000 has been placed on the table, actually, at the last meeting and at this meeting. So that might be something that satisfies everyone. It might not be. So, but if that is the approach that, I mean, we certainly understand that we can regroup, and we actually, there's no additional work that needs to be done on that front. We can just simply change it to $5,000 instead of $2,000.
Although I do like what Serena said about the quarterly. So if it was $2,000 quarterly, which would then raise it to, what, $6,000 a year, which is just $1,000. But I don't know if that's more burdensome.
Yeah.
We should think about that. Okay. We should think about that. Yeah.
I think that the additional filing may not get us where we want to go in terms of organizations that are exempt but don't necessarily have the resources to continue to file.
Right. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No.
Well, I was going to change direction just a little bit to create a little bit more clarity with regard to expanding the exemption. It sounded like there might be some interest in not having a blanket exemption for every 501c3, but perhaps the categorical exemption for certain kinds of 501c3s, expanding that might be an appropriate path to take. Is there some thought about what beyond we have proposed should be incorporated into that exemption?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think Commissioner Murray would prefer the blanket exemption.
That is my mm-hmm. preference, and I know I'm, you know, on my own little island.
No, I don't.
You can move over. because, you know, in my experience, I've participated and I've been on different 501c3 boards, and yes, some are providing direct services to the homeless. Others are providing educational opportunities to disadvantaged youth, not necessarily indigent youth, but disadvantaged youth. So that's just the way that I'm thinking about things.
And so then one of the examples that was raised by a public speaker was a 501c3 that's focused on arts. Would that be something that you would feel should be incorporated into the exemption?
Well, I can, if they're providing art lessons like at Barnstable Park, they're providing services free of charge, or they're supporting a museum that is a nonprofit that provides educational opportunities to the community and especially disadvantaged youth, and have programs to incorporate that. Mm-hmm. I feel that would still be a blanket exemption. And again, as Commissioner Warden pointed out, you know, we could have more conversations about the tinkering, about expanding. I haven't thought the whole thing through, but I'm just thinking the organizations that I'm aware of, I don't have a problem those being blanket exemptions. But as Mr. Sutton brought out, and some of the inferred that, you know, and I think Commissioner Dayan said that sometimes people just say, hey, I'm just going to say I'm a 501c3 in order to scooch past the lobbying laws. That's not what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So.
Commissioner Murray, am I hearing that you have expressing somewhat of opening up this exemption, the categorical blanket exemption, if the organization has a particular bent on providing educational services,
educational service, you know, nonprofit providing education to things like disadvantaged youth. I'm just saying that, you know, of course, I think what we're saying, it needs to be fleshed out a little bit more. I mean, that's just the position I'm at now, because I haven't thought of an organization that would not be exempt. But again, I understand through the commentary about, we don't just want to say, you know, it's a free reign, and somebody who just opens up a 501c3, even if they could technically meet all the categories, and they all of a sudden they're trying to do that to circumvent reporting requirements. I'm not interested in that.
Well, and we may be getting closer to where we want to get, because we're raising the number, so we might be getting to kind of a happier place.
That's true, too.
I just wanted to give some context. I think we're all in agreement in terms of one. I mean, my interest is definitely in trying to not have a chilling effect on nonprofits, you know, making sure that their resources really go to executing their work and not compliance. That said, having had some experience seeing how city government works, I can give an example where there can be an arts-focused nonprofit organization that will come and lobby the city on something that doesn't have, let's say it's, you know, maybe it's a conservationist group, so take away the arts, it's a conservationist group that wants to preserve a building, up against another nonprofit that focuses on housing, who wants to turn that building into low-income housing or housing for the homeless or something like that. And what we're proposing, the public won't know either side, regardless of what their position is. Both of them are coming from a good space. Both of them are furthering their mission. Both of them are trying to make Los Angeles better. But what we're proposing with the blanket exemption would be, in essence, to not let the public know who's on which side. And, you know, throw in the developer, and I promise you that there's a good likelihood that the developer is going to be getting one of those two nonprofits involved, because that's unfortunately what happens. I mean, to be an effective lobbyist, you have to build coalitions, and a lot of times that means recruiting nonprofits. Why? Because government officials recognize that nonprofits do come from a good place, and nonprofits are really looking at this bigger picture. And I don't think that it's anything bad about nonprofits, but I do think that in an effort to preserve transparency, we have to at least recognize some implications of a blanket exemption. Those are what my questions are trying to get to in terms of the transparency. And we do have to balance that with what, on the other side of, we don't want our regulations to keep them out of the conversation either.
That's an excellent point, and that's one of the things that we struggled with as a staff in our conversations. The example that we used was different from yours. It was about the minimum wage issue. You could have a nonprofit that is about supporting, livable wages on one side of the issue, and the Chamber of Commerce and the businesses that have to pay these salaries on the other side of the business. And if there was a blanket exemption for everyone,
and or the Chamber has a nonprofit. I mean, I know they have a nonprofit too that also speaks on their issues sometimes, and they can because.
Yeah,
they're allowed to. So
right, but the point of making sure that the public has the information that it should have about who is trying to influence the city on both sides of the coin. Yeah.
And just one other, not on the concept, but the more concrete information that we could have about who truly is covered now and what the whole picture of who would be covered. If we went with any of these alternatives, that would help a lot.
So then I think given your last comment, then I think that is maybe specific enough to go forward. If we, Mr. Hardy, that's up to you, but if we kind of come with the assumption, which it seems like there's a quorum for raising to 5,000, and then we look at maybe what would happen to the 501c3s under the pre-existing recommendation to expand the exemption, with maybe some more detail of who that
and the total community in the city of Los Angeles of nonprofits. What are we really talking about?
That's not a reinvention for you, but that's enough for us to get to a space where we at least have a quorum going forward. Is that realistic? No is a completely appropriate answer.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think we can do that and. Yeah, I certainly agree that more information will, I think, be helpful in trying to drive this to a more concrete level where we can get some consensus.
So I would move to conceptually approve what we've conceptually discussed in terms of item number 5. Do I have a second? Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Great. As is our practice, we take... That concludes our action items. So as is our practice, we take the informational items on consent, unless there are any questions, but we do have, after we take them on consent, some more public comment. Are there any questions on the informational items?
Yes. If I could inquire of Mr. Perez, there was an audit of several committees, including... Councilman, the race of Councilman Curran Price and also Anna Cubas. I should disclose that they're both friends of mine. And there was is it a sanction against Ms. Cubas for her violations? And I'm just wondering why that wasn't sort of included in the normal things that we go there has been an agreement and... members of the public have been sanctioned for not complying with the ethics law.
Commissioner Murray, thank you for your question. Just for the record, my name is Sergio Perez. I am the Director of Enforcement. It's been a while. Commissioner Orden, welcome. The issues that you're discussing are actually issues that were handled within our audit division. There is an early resolution audit policy, which is on our website, and it describes the situations in which certain audit findings merit a treatment that results in an early resolution audit agreement and not an enforcement investigation or a stipulation and exhibit or a contested administrative hearing. So the agreements that you are referring to were actually handled within our audit division.
Okay, so that's like at the early stages and didn't rise to the level of a full investigation.
That's right. Okay. And in our early resolution audit policy is on our website. It does describe the instances in which an audit can result in an early resolution audit agreement.
So no further action needs to be taken by
it. It's like the quick fix. I think we talked about that right before you joined the commission.
Okay. That's all right.
I mean, I understand the policy, but this is the first, which is great that people want to resolve the matter at early stage. I was just wondering why it wasn't handled differently. I know it's a little bit different, so thank you for that.
No, thank you, Commissioner Murray. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on the informational items? Oops. Sorry? We have public comment.
Yes.
So, Mr. Wayne, public comment on the informational items.
Yeah, so we got item six. So we have, you also had a related item, which is a shame you didn't put together Ms. Martinez's packet. So the Board of Harbor Commissioners. So you look at your report on his Form 60, 33016. He says, declaring the penalty of perjury, I have no interest that would qualify for Form 60 disclosure. Yet, on February 3rd, 2016, and March 3rd, 16, he issued CEC Form 51s for two interests, DirecTV stock, and the Eastview Little League. So if he's February 3rd, 2016, and March 3rd, 2016, he knows that he has conflicting interests. Why didn't he put them on his March 30th, 2016 Form 60? See, it's because nobody reads these reports, and they're back there in the box. And, of course, you're okay with all of this. He can continue to sit on the board and receive millions of dollars of future compensation from interests that are gaining financial gain through the Port Authority and the Harbor Commission. And then this thing here with, you can just look at the bulk of this Vilma Martinez. You know, you can't recommend that both of these people just get the hell off this commission. Commissions are not supposed to be places for pork. It's just supposed to be a place to go, non-conflicting, third-party, objective, unbiased issues. We need people, real humans, to go over this stuff and be a check, because the city council can't be a check. They're paid off. Nobody's a payoff. This is the only way that we can stop this, and these people are so embedded, there's no way to define how to stop these conflicts. And that's on item six. So do I get a, I put a card on seven and eight as well?
Yes.
All right. Now you look at the election updates, and it's the usual disgusting thing that we always see. I mean, millions of $6.8 million just in one quarterly report to buy the mayor's office, the city attorney's office, the controller, 15 council offices, and three LAUSD offices. That's all they're doing is they're buying these offices. Nobody's voting. They're just buying these offices. Something has got to be done about this. Something's got to change. And Governor Brown just signed a law allowing for the public financing of elections. This panel needs to pass a new structure to get this out and stop this. Because none of these people getting elected are going to be beholden to anybody except their campaign donors. It's an impossibility. Nobody can look at this kind of money, $2.6 million for the mayor's race, $463,000 for Paul Koretz's race, against an unknown. And you know how it's going to work out. You know that none of the non-incumbents are going to win. All these incumbents are going to ram through there because they just have so much money. There's so much money in these people. There's no way that anybody can fairly run a race against this kind of power. It's become a closed shop. And that's why we're having all of these troubles that we see in all of the blogs and all these communications. And that's why none of you do anything about this when these ethics issues come up. It's because the money is just too entrenched. And so now we'll get to item eight, the lobbying report. Now, the lobbying report is interesting because, congratulations, Englander, Kanabe, and Allen once again is on top. You know, they should be. Because you know what Englander Kanabe likes to do? They got a person named Eric Rose, which on your report on item 8, page 18, Eric Rose, you forgot to list who he works for. Works for Englander Kanabe and Allen. He's a partner, isn't he? But you just list him as an individual conducting $950 for Mitchell Farrell and David Rue's office holder account. But you see, Eric Rose has been busy. Eric Rose lobbied the State Bar of California to take my law license away for speaking at public meetings in May 2016. See, that's a lobbying activity. So, see, this is the problem with your city. You get your Xeroxes, you get all these people, they put this money together, $1 million, they enrich these people, they influence our legislation, and then you tick off one councilman, and the next thing you know, you got them over writing articles in the newspapers that a person's a terrorist. You got them going over and trying to take his license, and then they're calling my office for death threats thanks to Englander, Kanabi, and Allen, representing the L.A. City Attorneys Association, who used a city attorney to get a 3-year restraining order against me with a perjured set of packet documents. Now, that's why this city is a goddamn disgrace. That's why this city needs to stop doing this. But you see, you're not going to stop doing this. So we have a couple of law firms now. And, you know, it'll be litigated. But you guys will sit right in those chairs. You'll put your heads down. And you won't realize this kind of money. This place is a mafia operation, the city of Los Angeles. It's not a municipal corporation.
All right. That concludes public comment. The meeting is adjourned.
What about us?
general public comment, we've concluded. And announcements and requests to schedule items. I'm sorry.
Serena left, but she'd mentioned it at the beginning, and I think, Melinda, you were here for that, too, about the meeting starting earlier, because 10 o'clock being kind of late for us. So that was something we were going to bring up, and I know she left, so I was just going to raise that about having earlier meetings.
We should have a discussion about that for the time that works the best for the commission as a whole. The last meetings that have been held at 10 o'clock have been adjusted because of scheduling conflicts. So we can change that for December, and we can think about what next year should look like, which at the December meeting, which is when we always adopt our schedule for the following year.
I can't change it for December because I have an 8 a.m. meeting.
Okay.
But we can certainly talk about the next fiscal year when we change our – and now we have a new commissioner, so we should talk about what times works for everybody.
Any of those times are fine for me.
Okay. We have historically had meetings at 9:30. Is that also not a time that works? I just want to make sure we're presenting something, making a recommendation that will work for people.
Let's email. I'll individually email Serena so we don't have
any
issue.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other announcements? Okay.
Welcome.
Commissioner Orden, thank you for joining us for our first meeting.
Thank you.
I also, again, want to thank the staff. You put a lot of work into this, and I know that my feeling is that if kind of everybody hates what you're saying, then you got it about right. So well done. And no, that's not what we heard at all. Obviously, we heard that you're getting very close to it. And so, you know, we kind of come in here every 8 weeks and dissect what you've done, but we know that you spend the lion's share of 8 weeks doing it. So to everybody who came up today and otherwise is behind the scenes, we just want to again say we really appreciate it. And we will see everybody on December 6th. So thank you so much.